Welcome to Rapham Focus, a podcast devoted to exploring the provocative and impactful aspects of the research published in regional anesthesia and pain medicine. Here, we'll make sure to discuss and debate the findings that matter most for clinicians, patients, and policymakers. I'm Brian Seitz, Editor-in-Chief. I am an anesthesiologist and professor at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center. At Rapham, we believe well-done pain medicine improves health and well-being. I'll work to keep the discussion relevant and factual. Thanks for joining us. Let's get started. It never gets old. The interest in better understanding the safety and efficacy of regional anesthesia is a central tenet for both the clinician and researcher. There is ongoing interest among the research community to understand the implications and avoidance of phrenic nerve block. The challenge in clinical anesthesia is that phrenic nerve sparing blocks are thought to be either technically more challenging or less efficacious than the good old standard interscalene block. As such, a better understanding of factors associated with increased risk of clinical respiratory complications is warranted. This is especially true in the ambulatory setting, where oxygen therapy and monitoring is not possible upon discharge. This is why Rapham was delighted to support the work of Dr. Lei Su and Dr. Ed Mariano. Dr. Lei Su is a clinical assistant professor in the Department of Anesthesiology at Stanford. She received her medical degree from Stanford, and she completed her residency in anesthesiology at the University of California, San Francisco, and then a fellowship in regional anesthesia and acute pain medicine at Stanford. She is interested in the application of regional anesthesia outside the operating room, and her research interests include studying the functional outcomes of clinical pathways that include regional anesthesia in the primary arthroplasty in acute trauma populations. Dr. Ed Mariano is a professor and senior vice chair in the Department of Anesthesiology at Stanford. He has developed techniques and patient care pathways to improve postoperative pain, patient safety, and other outcomes, and has published over 250 peer-reviewed articles. He has held leadership positions in the California Society of Anesthesiologists, American Society of Anesthesiologists, American Society of Regional Anesthesia and Pain Medicine, and multiple journal editorial boards. So, Dr. Su and Dr. Mariano, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us on.
Thank you for having us.
In their retrospective observational study, over 1,000 patients were evaluated undergoing total shoulder replacement with a continuous interscalene block. Respiratory complications were categorized into four groups: none, mild, moderate, and severe. Now, so we can just get things started off here. Can you guys tell us a little bit about how you got the idea for the investigation? You suggested in the introduction that interscalene blocks are important to the success of these surgeries, but there remain concerns about the respiratory morbidity. I am really curious to know if you had any personal experiences that influenced you. I can't tell you how many times I have personally seen patients teetering with oxygen sats in the low 90s who were supposed to go home, which is actually why I was actually, you know, very, very interested in this work.
Yeah. So this is a great question. And the answer is exactly that. When I was a fellow, I had a couple of cases where patients who otherwise had no absolute contraindications to interscalene nerve blocks develop respiratory distress either shortly after receiving the nerve block in pre-op or after the surgery in post-op. Of course, they all had an extensive workup to rule out pneumothorax and other potential causes, but ultimately it was felt to be related to phrenic nerve block as a side effect of the interscalene nerve block. Fortunately, these cases were very few compared to our overall volume, but they stood out in my mind. When I started as an attending in my first year, I observed a couple other cases as well. And I felt that anecdotally, there were some similar characteristics between the patients who did poorly, but I couldn't be sure without doing further investigation. And these experiences inspired me to research this question.
I can fill in a little bit more detail on how we even came up with this concept. I mean, this was really all Lei's idea. And we sat down to talk about this particular research question. And as many of you probably know, myself and many colleagues have been looking at, discussing, researching these issues of new types of blocks to avoid complications. And I think, you know, we've written editorials about whether or not it makes sense to try to sacrifice good analgesia in favor of trying to avoid potential complications. And many times now that our diagnostic tests like bedside ultrasound are so good, it makes it really easy for us to detect lack of movement of the diaphragm even when patients aren't having respiratory distress. And so the question really of how often do patients experience clinical respiratory distress, I think, is a very important one for us, because oftentimes we tend to try to fix problems that don't need solving, and so it's really important, I think, when we're trying to find opportunities for improvement, that we focus on real problems that actually make a difference for patient care. As an aside, the reason why we had this great collaborator, Professor Stavros Mamsoudas, is that Stavros and I have known each other for over 20 years, and so he got into big data research as an anesthesiologist before many of us thought it was cool. And so when we had questions about outcomes related to this particular question, he was really the first person I reached out to find out, has this already been done?
So in other words, like phone a friend was a good...
Exactly. Phone a friend. Phoning a friend is always a good research good research approach. So that's how we started collaborating with our friend Stavros.
And I think that's a good summary for others out there about when you're thinking about a project. It is really helpful too to think about the things that really inspire you on a day-to-day level that have real operational implications in your own practice. And I think you alluded to this, but there's a lot of resources that have to go into figuring out why someone's hypoxic. So you can't just always just assume it's the phrenic nerve block. So if these patients are becoming hypoxic, you're talking about a lot of angst and resources and anxiety across the board from patients, their families, and the providers. So this is kind of a big topic. So I really, really appreciate you guys taking it on. And I think it's also probably helpful before we get into the results for you to summarize a little bit about the technique in the care pathway at your institution for the total shoulder replacement patient, because that'll help put things into context. Like, and in particular, are there like exclusion criteria, let's say, in terms of like lung function that you would consider?
Yeah. So just going over the summary of the care for total shoulder arthroplasty patients, I'll start off with the preoperative nerve block procedure. So at our institution, continuous interscalene nerve block catheters are part of the institutional clinical pathway for shoulder arthroplasty patients. And the procedures are typically performed preoperatively in the patient's preoperative room by regional anesthesiologists and trainees using a block room model. Typically, the nerve block catheter is inserted using an in-plane technique from a posterior to anterior direction, and the catheter tip is left in the interscalene groove. We do the procedure sterilely with gown, cap, gloves, and sterile field. And then one of the surgical concerns when we're doing this procedure is to avoid getting too close to the surgical site. So we always are carefully dress our nerve block catheters and tape it to the opposite shoulder, either anteriorly or posteriorly around the neck. When you think about people who we would not offer nerve blocks to, they tend to be people with severe lung disease. So very severe, like COPD, who is on home oxygen, would be someone that we would not offer the nerve block to. And people who, incidentally, we found out by an old chest x-ray, or there's a history of known contralateral phrenic nerve dysfunction, then we also don't offer them nerve blocks. But people with like mild respiratory disease, we will still offer them nerve blocks. When we do the nerve block, a typical loading dose of local anesthetic is 10 to 20 milliliters of 0.5% ropivacaine. And then the patient is taken to the OR by the primary anesthesia team and undergoes general anesthesia for the surgery. In the PACU, the nurses will connect the patient's nerve block catheter to a Nimbus pump. Previously, we used the OnQ pump, but we switched to Nimbus pumps in 2017. And the typical default program is ropivacaine 0.2%, 5 milliliters every hour for an autobolus, with a 5 milliliter every 30-minute possible demand bolus from the patient. The overwhelming majority of these shoulder arthroplasty patients stay at least one night, and their care team includes orthopedic surgeons, internal medicine hospitalists, and the acute pain service. And the acute pain service is anesthesiologists and nurse practitioners. And it's up to the acute pain service to educate and discharge patients with the Nimbus pumps. I would say the majority of them actually do go home with the Nimbus pumps if they've done clinically overall.
Okay, well, that's a great overview. Ed, anything to add to that? That's a nice snapshot, I think.
Yeah, no, I think it's an interesting practice. So at Stanford Healthcare, you know, we tend to use electronic pumps. These are reusable. There are many kinds. And so I don't want people to think that you have to use one particular type of pump. At our Veterans Affairs Palo Alto Healthcare System, all patients having shoulder arthroplasty also routinely get a continuous nerve block as part of our practice protocol. So that's universal across our two health systems. The difference being that the nerve block catheter regimens over at the Veterans Affairs Palo Alto, they tend to be basal infusion with patient controlled bolus rather than intermittent program bolus. Yeah, those are really the only differences, but overall the doses are fairly similar, and the use of catheter infusion over a single injection is also the same within our system.
Fantastic, and I know we talked a little bit about this at the RAPM board meeting that you were at, Ed. The lack of robust funding for regional anesthesia and pain medicine in the community, and how I'm always amazed how people are so creative and somehow figure out a way to get their projects done even without these big fancy grants, and that was kind of true in this situation too. You had some departmental funding, but you pulled it off without external support. Can you maybe share maybe some tricks or suggestions for other young researchers who might be in a similar situation, and maybe help them feel like not fatalistic about the ability to get such projects done?
Well, I will say that I'm very fortunate to work at Stanford, which is a wonderful academic institution that supports junior investigators. My first piece of advice to budding researchers is to find a mentor, or better yet, find multiple mentors. At Stanford, Drs. John Louis Horn and Ban Sui encourage all of us in the regional anesthesia division to apply for funding for research, because no matter how small, every little bit counts. Even a small grant like $10,000 can help pay for the time of a research assistant to help gather data, or a statistician who can help analyze data, as it did in my case. When I was able to obtain funding, I asked Dr. Mariano if he'd be interested in mentoring me as a senior author on this project, and I've learned a lot from him. And one of the greatest pieces of advice that he gave me was to find additional collaborators to both decrease the workload, but also to strengthen my own network. No one man or woman can be an island when it comes to research, so having a team of people really contributed to the successful completion of the project.
Yeah, one of the things that I think I always try to pass on to mentees too is that you can't completely fall in love with your clinical question, because as many of us have learned the hard way, not all great clinical questions can lead to great research projects or get published. So I think it's really helpful, I think, to take the approach that good clinical care generates great clinical research, but you need to keep asking all of those questions. You have to keep throwing questions out there until something sticks. And the more you can develop your network of collaborators, the more you have this fantastic feedback mechanism to figure out which questions move forward. Because for every one question that we may pursue as a real research project, we've probably thrown out 30 to 50 other questions that have probably come up in clinical practice, not because they're not important in terms of care, but because maybe it's difficult to measure, or maybe we don't have adequate controls, or maybe we don't have the right resources to conduct that particular type of study design. And so I think it is really helpful, I think, to feel comfortable reaching out. And I think that nowadays, we've had incredible amounts of connectivity in various ways with collaborators across the world. So you can reach out and get some feedback, even on some ideas early on. I think the toughest thing right now is for people to suffer losses and rejections, because it really discourages people who may have very productive academic careers from staying on track. And so I really encourage people who have that interest in scholarship. Yeah, that you try to stick with it. Don't get frustrated right away, but really try to find good collaborators and mentors who can help you vet some of those questions before you pursue ideas that may not lead to a fruitful publication.
Wow, those are great words of wisdom. Thank you both for those answers. Now we're going to get into the study a little bit here, but before we do that, I think it's really important that we define the categories of respiratory complications for the listeners. Yeah, and I recall going back and forth with you guys a little bit on this when we were doing the revisions, trying to make sure we had these in meaningful categories. Now that's your outcome is respiratory complications. So could you just start by just summarizing those categories?
So respiratory complications were divided into mild, moderate, or severe, as adapted from a previous paper by Fernandez Bustamante et al. Mild was defined as being on supplemental oxygen at any time after 12 hours post-PACU discharge. Moderate was defined as requiring chest imaging for respiratory symptoms within the first 3 postoperative days. A severe respiratory complication was defined as requiring a higher level of respiratory support, so high-flow nasal cannula, non-rebreather mask, non-invasive or invasive positive pressure ventilation. Severe respiratory complications also included admission to the ICU, cardiac or pulmonary arrest, or readmission after discharge within a 3-day postoperative period with respiratory symptoms. 3 days was chosen as the duration of the postoperative period to examine because patients are routinely instructed by the regional anesthesia service to remove the nerve block on or before postoperative day 3.
Okay. And I would just highlight here for those practices that are doing ambulatory total shoulders that oxygen, the need for oxygen therapy, which is listed as a minor respiratory complication, actually can become a major complication because you've changed the entire plan and you can't send someone home on oxygen. So I just want to stress that that even the mild findings here, I think, have relevance to a larger audience in terms of the impact operationally.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, we're seeing, shoulder in particular, I think, as far as arthroplasty goes, has really started to quickly move to the ambulatory setting. And by ambulatory, we mean freestanding ambulatory, not attached to a hospital. And we're seeing other joint replacements move that way as well. And I think that, once site of service is not an issue at some point, then we may see more of this. And so you're absolutely right. I think that we often are taught, I think, in medical school that oxygen is a drug. And so, this is probably the most relevant in this case, because if an ambulatory patient needs to have oxygen therapy and there's no overnight stay option at a freestanding ambulatory surgery center, then guess what? That patient's getting sent over to the nearest hospital by ambulance.
Right, which is a big deal. Okay, now the fun part. Please summarize the findings for us.
Yeah, so the primary outcome for our study was the incidence of clinical respiratory complications. So between January 2014 and June 2021, we had 1,025 elective adult shoulder arthroplasty cases included in our study. Of these 1,025 cases, 351 or 34% had any respiratory complication. This was subdivided into 279 mild, 61 moderate, and 11 severe respiratory complications. So in total, there were 72 patients, so about 7%, who had moderate or severe respiratory complications. And of these 72, 56% of those 72 patients were identified by hospital clinicians as having phrenic nerve block from the interscalene as the sole cause or part of the cause of the patient's respiratory symptoms. So in our unadjusted univariate analysis, we looked at patient-specific, surgery-specific, and nerve block-specific variables. And among patients divided into the 4 possible categories of outcomes, there were differences in non-modifiable characteristics such as age, gender, BMI, ASA, preoperative oxygen saturation, and some pre-existing comorbidities that included lung disease, sleep apnea, heart failure, and a history of prior home oxygen use. Univariate analysis also identified differences in modifiable factors like hospital length of stay, total opioids consumed postoperatively, and nerve block infusion regimen. When we performed a multivariable logistic regression analysis to explore potential associations between the predetermined collected variables and the outcome, we found that the baseline characteristics of age, ASA physical status, BMI, preoperative oxygen saturation, asthma, and congestive heart failure had statistically significant association with the outcome. The model estimates indicated that having a higher BMI, advanced age, or lower preoperative SpO2 were all associated with any respiratory complications. And if you actually plot this out, you can see that the median BMI and the median age increased steadily over the severity of the outcome. And even more interestingly, the median preoperative oxygen saturation decreases steadily as the severity of the outcome increased. So for every 1% decrease in the patient's preoperative SpO2, there was an associated 32% increase in the likelihood of any respiratory complication.
This, it's funny because I read so many papers in my role as editor-in-chief of the journal, and I love this opportunity to kind of revisit the papers that we accepted. And I just think this is an amazing paper and findings. I mean, I'm really blown away by this 34% rate of any complication because again, even the mild ones are significant in the ambulatory setting. And so I think that this paper really should be referenced for surgeons and for policymakers, because it might be that because your patients were in the hospital, there was a liberalization of the oxygen use. Whereas if you were trying to get someone home, you'd kind of see how they did it hanging out at 90. You know, so that could be a little bit like going on, but still, though, this is really saber rattling. And I want to make just one comment here, and I know Ed, you want to probably say something about this, but I really like how you present the raw data first in an observational study, and I think too many researchers try to get all fancy with modeling really early on. But the reality is, this is a real world pragmatic thing. We want to see what's going on with these rates. And the fact that you highlight that first, I want to congratulate you, and I want the listeners to know that you should try to do that too if you're submitting a paper. The modeling is great, but it's all exploratory, and the idea here is that you're trying to find the next research project. So if you get a signal here on something, let's say it's a baseline hypoxemia, which kind of makes sense, right? That would be a great further study where you really define where those thresholds are to have a problem. But I think you probably want to say something about that, Ed.
Yeah, no, I think your comments are perfect. I mean, I think that for every scientific paper, I think really has to tell a story. And I think that, and I try to think about that, not just in the design part, but when we try to frame a paper, the background really has to explain why is this question important? How does it add to our body of knowledge? And the fact that we don't have these kind of clinical data, when we're discussing with patients or discussing with our colleagues how we manage patients, is an important reason why we wanted to find the answer. And so I think describing how you perform the study, I think in the methods, is important because you want people to know that here are the definitions we used. If you use different definitions, you may have different answers, but this is why. It justifies why we created our methodology around these established categories. And then trying to tell the story, I think you're right. Sometimes we jump right into the fancy statistics, but really the question we wanted to answer was this one. It was like, how often do we see any respiratory complication? And this is a clinical manifestation. It's not diaphragmatic paresis without any subjective symptoms. It's what did the patients need, and how many actually need some intervention? And I think that's really key. The other question that's, I'm sure, that will come up in the discussion, maybe on social media, is going to be, well, this is why I don't do catheters. Well, I think that what's really important to look at here is that whether or not you place a catheter, our initial yeah, local anesthetic choice, you know, was actually a longer acting local anesthetic. So not so different than what, you know, many of our colleagues would do when performing single injection. It's just that, you know, we may not necessarily, you know, have the same thresholds at our institutions, you know, to detect and also treat, you know, some of these, even what we consider mild respiratory complications. But I think this is actually happening out there too. And it's really a matter of just being aware of it, not necessarily to discourage people, because of course, you know, I love the regional anesthesia. But it's really just so that way we're aware, especially when counseling patients and our colleagues.
But I'd also say though, if I was a medical director or a business operational leader at, let's say, a new ambulatory surgery center that was, or not even a new center, but one that was entertaining starting an ambulatory total joint arthroplasty program, shoulder, I would look at this paper, your paper, and I would have a lot of questions about the appropriateness in patient selection. And that's why I think the modeling really, really is important here, and in a follow-up study is even more important to really hone in on who's appropriate to do, because again, you can't send people home on oxygen. And so this is why I think this is so important. And I had, not to get too far off the discussion of the paper, but I had this thought that I wanted to ask you guys about in terms of it being useful. What, since you're putting a catheter in, and I know I've done this before in my practice when I was worried about someone's respiratory mechanics post phrenic nerve block, I've used chloroprocaine through the catheter to basically get a short little block and assess their kind of functional status, if you will, almost while they're waiting to go back to surgery. And if, you know, like suddenly you're on 6 liters of oxygen and dyspneic, that tells a different story than someone that doesn't really notice any difference. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I think that's a really great approach. I mean, that's the reason why people choose certain local anesthetics, I think it's often frequently practice dependent. Yeah, obviously, I think that our institutions, you know, Stanford Healthcare, as well as over at Veterans Affairs, you know, patients tend to stay at least one night. And that's typical. I think that, you know, for many times because they just travel from far away. But because of that, you know, we have a much lower threshold to use a longer acting upfront. But you know, for patients in whom we expect, you know, like we already have, like at our Veterans Affairs Hospital, if they've already arranged that they are going home the same day, then we actually use a short acting local anesthetic for the placement of catheter. And I think you're right. You know, one of the nice things about that is you can assess, yeah, how they function postoperatively and also symptomatically, because I do think that you know, what really matters, I think, for us is one, you know, how does the patient feel subjectively, and do they actually require clinical intervention? Those are the things that would affect their disposition.
Yeah, and I should have probably clarified that what I'm doing with the chloroprocaine is that I'm using more of like a test as opposed to the actual local anesthetic that I would use subsequent to that. So if like they pass the test, I would probably just use the standard, you know, 0.2% ropivacaine infusion or bolus the catheter with a longer acting solution.
That's one thing in our practice too. Yeah, you're right. Because, you know, I mean, one advantage, I think, of the catheter infusion that we found, you know, just from, you know, our experiences in the various places where we've worked, is that you can always stop the infusion. And so the advantage, I think, of being able to have that type of control, especially in patients in whom you don't know if you're going to have a symptomatic or intervention requiring respiratory distress, I think is key. I think the titratable nature of perineural infusion, I think, is extremely attractive. It's one of the sites, I think, where we do nerve blocks that we consider high stakes. Right, and because it has the so much potential benefit, but it still has very common associated risks compared to many of our other nerve block and plexus sites.
That's all great points. Now, so here's the big, I guess, policy question: after performing this study and analyzing the data, how should we change, if at all, clinical practice?
Well, I do think that's a really interesting question. And like we've kind of talked about so far, we just have to be thoughtful about who we offer continuous interscalene nerve blocks to and make sure we have the appropriate resources and support for monitoring. You guys were talking about how, like, you know, using chloroprocaine to see how they do. I would say since we've done this study, overall, as a division, we've changed our practice a little bit after the study was completed. We looked at our results because we're more aware of the respiratory complications that were coming up. So now we tend to, if patients look like, you know, they're very elderly, they look frail, they have a higher BMI, their preoperative SpO2 is not 99 or 100% coming in, we're a little bit more hesitant to do the standard interscalene nerve block that we used to do. We consider alternatives. We have alternatives like the erector spinae plain block catheter that our group published a study about. And then also a lot of us will do, instead of the standard, it used to be 10 cc's or 20 cc ropivacaine bolus, we'll do something very small, like 3 to 5 cc's. I also thoroughly counsel patients now that the number one side effect of this nerve block is that it can impact their breathing. And that if we find that it impacts their breathing, they won't be able to go home with it. We'll have to take it out. One of the advantages of having the catheter, though, is that there is a way to kind of wash out the local, which is another study that our group published.
Fantastic. And I actually want to make a comment about the 3 to 5 mL dosing. And I think that's my clinical experience too, that these larger bolus doses seem to be more symptomatic. Now I hear Andre Bozart's voice in the back of my head saying that's not true, because if you get a brachial plexus block that's clinically effective, you're also getting a phrenic nerve block and there's no way around it. But I must say, even though I respect Andre so much, that's not my clinical experience. I found these when 20, 30 mLs is given, it's a different thing than what you're saying. So I actually do the same exact thing.
Yeah. And it's true. I mean, I remember the days when, you know, we would routinely inject 40 mils. You know, I remember, you know, of local anesthetic. I remember going to, as a visiting professor, to visit another esteemed institution, and they would actually connect a 50 mil syringe when doing interscalene block with nerve stimulation. And I thought, wow, you know, I can see why. Yeah, there's probably a higher likelihood of getting a nerve block when you do it that way. But I think now with ultrasound, I mean, you're right. I mean, our techniques, I think, have evolved a great deal. And as Lay already pointed out, that there are some alternatives to what we consider the more traditional interscalene brachial plexus block. And even moving slightly more distal in the interscalene groove. I mean, thinking about the interscalene brachial plexus block as a compartment block, which is the way that I tend to teach it for our trainees, you can approach the superior trunk more distally. You have a higher likelihood of sparing the phrenic nerve, we know that while phrenic nerve paresis doesn't automatically mean that you get respiratory distress, it is probably a contributor. And so if you can reduce that rate of phrenic nerve block, then that's probably helpful, especially if you can do a block that doesn't sacrifice the analgesia. And I think that's a good example. I think from a systems perspective, because I think if you look at this study and say, wow, you know, that's a really high complication rate, you know, forget those catheters. The one thing that I think it's important to make sure that we always emphasize is that, it's a cohort study and every patient got a catheter. So we don't know how patients would have done after shoulder arthroplasty without having a catheter. So those patients who didn't get a catheter, they may have had other issues that would prevent their discharge, like pain, or maybe they would still have respiratory complications because they would have gotten a lot more opioids than our continuous nerve block patients. So we don't have a comparison group, at least as far as this study goes. But I think if your patient population and your standard protocol mimics what we do at our institution, then these data, I think, would be helpful for those readers and those listeners who have practices similar to ours.
And I'll tell you how your data influence me, and we do ambulatory total joint shoulder replacement at in our center, and we're only doing single injections now, and that's a whole another discussion, but which maybe we should do a whole other podcast on. But we have a resting pulse ox reading threshold that your study influenced us on, so thank you. I don't know if it's the
right
one.
That's great to hear.
That's very cool.
I don't know if it's the right number, but we're using 94%. But I will make this note though for our listeners. If somebody has baseline hypoxemia and you don't have an answer to it, like COPD, you really and they fit the typical
you know, pattern of being, you know, has a large BMI, you have to be really worried about obesity hypoventilation syndrome. And I actually spoke to a pulmonologist about this to some level, because we had someone that actually got, you know, really hypoxic post after a nerve block. And the issue really is that should probably be a contraindication to an interscalene block.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I think that just that our finding about the preoperative oxygen saturation, I mean, that's really, that's a measure, yeah, but it doesn't tell you underlying disease, yeah, but it does tell you that something's wrong. And I think that, you know, your point, I think about obesity, you know, hypoventilation, I think is really key. I think that sometimes, and I know we're all very susceptible to this, I think, as regional anesthesiologists, because our field is so technical. Yeah, but remember, that's the medical part. Right, that's the doctoring
right.
part.
That's the medicine. That's the
medicine. Something's wrong.
That's right. Yeah, no, and it's time to play doctor, right? And I would just say I guess the obesity hypoventilation syndrome situation is that often it gets explained as, oh, this is a large patient has sleep apnea, but remember they're awake. So they shouldn't be hypoxic when you're talking to them in the holding area. Yes, they probably have sleep apnea too, but that's not what's going on. So I just wanted to highlight that, because that's been something I've seen through the years, is that baseline hypoxemia that's not explained by COPD. I mean, you may still not want to do it even with the COPD, but at least you feel good, like, oh, I know what's going on. It's not something more sinister, or I mean, it could be, but you know. I wanted to, I guess, wrap this up by asking you what you think the next steps are in terms of research. You know, what would be like the next best steps?
That's a great question. As we kind of discussed, like all retrospective observational cohort studies, that the risk factors we identify are only associations, and we can't infer causal relationships. So I think the next logical step would be a prospective study to investigate these relationships by controlling for the nerve block specific and surgery specific variables, and testing only the patient specific variables.
I think on my wish list, and I think it's hard to study, but I do think that, you know, this study, as well as some of the other projects that we've worked on in recent history, have really pointed to the need for personalized perioperative pain management. That, you know, this is very helpful, I think, for us in terms of trying to identify patients at risk. But what we know matters, and I think you alluded to this, Brian, already, that, you know, each patient is different. We may have some risk factors, but our ability to predict who's going to have complications and who's going to have greater than expected severe acute pain are also not perfect. And so I think that, you know, as we're starting to move forward, that I do think that we're going to have to secure our place, I think, in medicine as physicians and as specialists, by really focusing on personalized pain management. And I think personally, the way to do that, I think, is by making sure that we provide titratable treatments that are target specific, that minimize the potential complications. And we're able to make those kinds of on the field plays, I think, when they need to happen. And I think that's really key. It does make the design of a clinical trial somewhat challenging, because, you know, one patient, you know, you may decide is perfect for a standard interscalene brachial plexus catheter. Another, you may decide, you know, is more appropriate for a superior trunk catheter. Another, you may decide, you know what, I don't want to send this patient home with a catheter at all. And all of those decisions, at least looking in retrospect, may be the right ones.
Right.
So yeah, I'll put that out there. It doesn't help in terms of designing a study, but those are my thoughts.
I mean, that's a good point, man. We don't, you have to make decisions with incomplete information all the time. And that's the nature of the art of medicine, right? We don't have the large RC, multiple RCT, you know, for every single decision you have to do. So that's a really good point. Wow. Good stuff. All right. So I think we covered everything. Thank you guys so much for the study and keep them coming.
No, we appreciate that. And actually, I just want to say, like, for people who are listening, I mean, I think, Brian, you're just an incredible editor-in-chief. I think that the way that you personalize the review and editorial process, the way you work with authors, to really get that product, that gets published, to the finish line, I think is really, it's really unique. And it's very, very much appreciated.
Oh, thanks. Yes. Aletta, and thank you. And we didn't plant that as a question. So thank you. So, or a statement. awesome. Thanks, guys.
Thank you for listening to the Wrap'em Focus podcast. Original music and production are done by Dan Langa. More information can be found at www.danlanga.com. We hope you'll join us in the future for more discussions with authors published in the Wrap'em Journal, and you can visit us at www.wrap'em.org.